this is way too pretentious and clever and perhaps assholic.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 31 for April 7th, 2014. I'm your host, Chris Webster. Coming up on the show today, we tackle a listener question, the first segment of our new Profiles in CRM airs, and we play an interview that Ashley recorded at the Northwest Anthropological Conference in Washington State last week. I just want to remind everyone that my new book, Field Archaeologist's Survival Guide, available from Left Coast Press this month, will be out within a few weeks. If you want to be in the running to win a free copy, then head over to my website at www.digtech-llc.com/podcast. Click the donate link. Donate anything over $1, and you will not only receive occasional premium content from the podcast, but you'll also be entered into a drawing for a free copy of the book. So don't forget to tell your friends and colleagues about the show. If you're working, then keep an ear out for your crew chief while you listen to the show. If you're not working, then go and sharpen your trowel and refresh that CV, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Hey, welcome to the show, everybody. Joining me today are Doug in Scotland.
Hello.
Steven in Wisconsin.
Hi.
Bill in Arizona.
Hello.
And Arizona is apparently on Pacific time, for all of you in question about that.
Yeah, and our worlds are still shattered by the fact that Wisconsin beat Arizona to the Final Four. And there were some horrible calls, but it was bad both ways.
Yeah, you didn't get maced, did you? Or whatever? Or tased?
My wife works for the university, and they sent this message out like, you know, all people, Tucson citizens, stay away from Main Gate Square, because that's where all the students, there's like an area with all these bars and stuff.
Yeah.
Stay away from Main Gate Square.
Nice.
So, yeah. Awesome. That's what happens when we lose. I can't wait to see what would happen if we won.
Right. Total chaos. Okay, first we're going to talk real quick about another podcast. It's called Indiana Jones, Myth, Reality in the 21st Century. It's by Joseph Schuldenrein, and he works for a company, a geoarchaeology company out in New York. And Doug and a former guest of the podcast, Terry Brock, were both on that show, and they were talking about blogging and social media in archaeology. Doug, why don't you give a quick synopsis of what you guys talked about on that show?
Yeah, the episode was basically social media, talking a lot about blogging and so forth. Really good episode, and I'd actually recommend to anyone who's listening to this, if you're looking for another podcast, the Myth Indiana Jones Reality podcast is excellent. They do fairly frequent, technically it's a radio show, but it's a online radio show, so, you know, basically a podcast, but you can listen to all the old episodes and basically follow along. And they do it fairly frequently, maybe once a week, every 2 weeks or so. So any listeners out there, I'd recommend actually checking out the whole show, not just my episode. But the episode I was on with Terry, we talked about social media, if you're interested in that.
Yeah, the show, I believe it is weekly. And it is, like you said, it is an online radio show, but you can listen live. They broadcast at, I want to say 6 p.m. Eastern on Wednesdays, but it's on the Voice America network, they call it. So, but we'll link to that in the show notes so you can find it pretty easily. It's also on iTunes and I think Stitcher. They're all over the place. If you type in Indiana Jones, it'll come up. Okay, some other big news since the last podcast was the cancellation or delayed release. They're not really being too clear on that, of the National Geographic Channel's Nazi War Diggers show. So I'm sure some people listening to this probably saw some of the pushback from that. There were, I think the morning it was canceled, the SAA president, the SHA, and a few other organizations got together and sent a letter to the National Geographic Channel and basically voiced their concerns. And one of the bigger concerns was the treatment of human remains. Because otherwise this show wasn't too different from American Diggers and, I don't know, whatever that other one was that came up here in the United States. This one was based in Europe, obviously, and dealing with World War II artifacts and sites, and they were going and digging up. And they said that they were donating these things to museums or other things like that. But I guess one of the guys was found online trying to hawk some of the things that he found. And so that was uncovered. And then, of course, their treatment of human remains, which they shouldn't have been dealing with human remains at all, really. I mean, they're not qualified to do that. It was just a bad deal all around. So I just wanted to mention that. I wrote a blog post about it. Doug, you see a lot of blogs. Did you see anything other than what I was talking about? What some concerns about the show?
Yeah, it was all over the place, especially on a lot of Facebook groups as well. Twitter, it basically exploded on social media. Good places to go to sort of catch up and see what's going on is Conflict Antiquities. It's run by Sam Hardy. I'm pretty sure I'm getting his name right. I apologize to Sam if I'm not. He's based here in the UK, and he's been tracking it, digging up a lot of stuff, asking questions, really good stuff. Paul Balford also has a blog, or he has a couple, where he tends to look at looting and heritage and so forth. And so he's been basically covering that as well. So those would be some good resources. I'd recommend Sam because he's been really doing a lot of posts on it and keeping track. And he's also been following up. So there's been some developments since they've canceled the show where it now looks like they kind of had some permissions, but maybe not. It's still all up in the air, but Sam's following that. So,
I'm sure they had some of the stuff, you know, on the up and up, and that really wasn't the question for me. The whole premise of the show was the question, whether they had permission or not. And a lot of these shows seem to get around the issue because they say they're digging on private land, they're dealing with private landowners, blah 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 blah. And you know, I understand the laws protect them in that case, but ethically, you know, the show is still a bad deal for archaeology.
It's also a little more complicated in Europe, where the laws are much different than they are in the United States.
I can imagine. Yeah.
So, and I'm not up on my Polish heritage laws or, Lithuania or Latvia, those right. areas where they're in.
Right.
But yeah, it is, there is a much more, emphasis on archaeology everywhere, not just public land.
Right.
So they're still figuring out who had permissions and who knew what. And I imagine the next couple of weeks we'll learn more.
Well, and I think one of the bad things about it is too, that the show was supposed to come out in May, which means the damage has essentially been done as far as the archaeological sites are concerned, because the show has been filmed. I mean, they film it all and edit it all and get it all packaged up and ready to go. And then they put it on TV. So it's not like a weekly sitcom. So the damage has been done. They've already done what they're going to do. So there's no taking that back. So I'm sure there'll be some backlash from that, if any. Let's move into an email. So I received this email through LinkedIn, and I'm just going to read it real quick. He's got a few questions, and we'll tackle those when I get done with the email. So it says, "Hi, Chris. I'm traveling through Southeast Asia at the moment with my lady friend." And first, I'd like to say somebody traveling through Southeast Asia and listening to our podcast is pretty cool. Anyway, traveling with my lady friend, who is also an archaeologist, and have been passing the many, many hours on buses with the CRM podcast. It's awesome. Thanks for putting it together. Excuse my ignorance here if you've touched on these topics in earlier podcasts or blogs, but I've thought of a few discussion topics that I've been recently scratching my head about. The first is Idaho's issue with isolated finds. Currently, all isolated finds are considered sites, be it a hole in top can or a single flake. This undoubtedly causes problems with survey and recording and wastes a lot of field time. This issue has been raised during the latest Idaho Professional Archaeological Council meeting and is waiting to be reformed. I can send you a brief if you're interested. With this, my question revolves around isolated finds in other states. Every state I've worked in has different requirements of what is considered an isolate. And he says, I believe Nevada's is 11 flakes, but actually it's one, because two artifacts here in Nevada makes a site. Whether they're a flake and a can, that's a multi-component site. So, you know, if they're within 30 meters, that's a site. He says, I'm just curious about what you and your archaeological comrades in arms think about isolated finds and how we as a larger CRM community should go about recording them. And he says his current employer, as well as most firms in Idaho, have been classifying isolates as noted but not recorded. In my mind, this just sidesteps the issue and gets us nowhere. So I'm going to hold it there and then tackle his other questions later. So, like he said, it's different in every state. Nevada is two artifacts within 30 meters, regardless what those artifacts are a site. So only one artifact is an isolate. In Utah, I know it's 10 artifacts, and I believe it's the same in Oregon, but I can't be sure of that. So in California, in certain areas as well, on BLM land, it's 9 artifacts and below is an isolate, and the 10 artifacts and above is a site. So, and an isolated feature in California is also a site. But we can have isolated features here in Nevada as long as it's part of a district and you get permission from the BLM. So if you're on some archaeological district, you can have a feature and just call it an isolated feature. But if it's an isolated feature outside of an archaeological district, then it's a site. So since this question deals with Idaho a little bit, Bill, do you have anything you can say about up there? Because I know you went to school up there, but I don't know how much work you did up there.
Yeah, I'm totally blown away because I don't know the answer. I do know what he's talking about. And part of the reason, I think in Idaho at least, is because you don't necessarily do shovel probes. Mm-hmm. As far as I remember, I only worked there for a few months, and it was on a full excavation of like an archaic site and right. Lewis and Clark site. So I never did any survey, but just what I remember people telling me from the rules. And also I have not read the rules for Idaho either, because I never had to work any projects there besides the one I did in grad school. At any rate, I do remember him saying that, yeah, like a single artifact could be considered a site. But you don't necessarily have to dig shovel probes. So in Arizona, everything is totally different. It's 30 artifacts of a single type. So it'd have to be 30 sherds or 30 flakes or something like that, or 20 of two different kind within a 30-meter area. So 10 flakes, 10 sherds, 19 flakes, one sherd, you know, then that becomes what, you know, we record as a site.
Yeah.
But in areas where there's a lot of grass or, you know, like up in the hills, you basically just don't find sites because we don't dig shovel probes.
Right.
So you never find, unless it's an awesome room block or a pueblo, you just don't find the site. And so I have a feeling that that's why Idaho's law is so, it seems ridiculous, but so stringent because, you know, they're not digging shovel probes. Although I think it's bad. It's just generally bad for these companies not to record IOs. And I was talking, at my last company, I was talking with them about recording these IOs and the importance of them. Even if all you're doing is taking a GPS point and in the notes writing down, you know, one can or something like that, or, you know, describing the artifact, over time, when you display those things across, you know, some kind of a GIS layer or something like that, you might actually find like concentrations or areas where there possibly could be sites, or maybe they were sites, but they've been looted, you know. So you look back at the records that the state has, you know, from 50 years ago, and it shows there used to be an archaeology site there, and all you found was one can or one arrowhead.
Right.
Well, there used to be a site there, but it's gone now.
Yeah, that is a good point. You know, just to say the comparisons here, in Nevada and in Utah, there's no shovel testing or shovel probing there either. But the rules are completely different between, say, Utah and Nevada. And, you know, I was just looking at a project that straddles the California-Nevada border up near Oregon. And, you know, their rules just across the border, you've got the same, let's say, cultural backgrounds. There's an arbitrary state border separating them. And yet on one side of the border, you record one way. And on the other side of the border, you record the other way. And in that area, I understand that, you know, making it 9 flakes or 9 artifacts as an isolate kind of makes sense because there is a lot of obsidian up there. And when you know, I'm not saying that you need to reduce the amount of recording that you do, but what really is a 2-flake, 100,000 2-flake sites going to tell you? The same that, you know, 10,000 9-flake isolates, as long as they're plotted on a GIS, like you said, Bill, somebody can go along later and look and say, well, there is a recognizable pattern here and we can see this. I think that's the point. The whole point is, does the state record the isolate on a GIS so somebody else can go look at it later on. If they do, then I personally don't care what their standards are, you know, as long as they're recorded somewhere and not just like Alex says here in the email, noted but not recorded. Noted but not recorded doesn't do anything.
Yeah, that's the worst. And not only that, but I just can't imagine, since an IO doesn't require a form or anything, really, you just got a Trimble. Yep. And all you're doing is taking a GPS point. I really can't see how that's, you know, totally destroying projects, because if you're taking a can here and then you're going 30 meters and you're taking another can and then you're going 30 and you're taking another can, well, you might want to look a little harder and look between the gaps, because you may actually have a site here.
Right.
You know, so if you're taking too many IOs, that also is telling you something, that maybe these IOs should be rolled together into a site boundary or something like that, or maybe things eroding away or being covered up by vegetation. Maybe you should use your foot to kick around and see if you see some more cans. I don't know, but I don't like recording IOs, except I understand the importance of doing it. Right. And so I just do it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you never know. It's hard to see at the scale of survey, rather than pulling back out Google Earth style and looking at the whole thing. You could be on a shallow hillside and recording an isolate every 40 meters for 700 meters or something like that. And then, you know, you start to realize, holy crap, maybe this is just a really big, really old site that's weathered and eroded out, and the artifacts are either buried or traveled down the hill or whatever. And you can't see that on the individual artifact level. So, hey, Stephen, what's the deal with isolates up in Wisconsin? Because I know you guys shovel test up there, right?
Yeah, we do. It varies, and I, for the life of me, I can't remember what, like, if there's like a statewide standard. I know I work on federal land, and, you know, that agency, you know, there's a specific set of guidelines. And actually, we've had to tweak it, because originally it was 5 artifacts. And it had to be like 5 artifacts from, you know, from more than one shovel test.
Right.
You know, the problem with that,
I think Ruckus disagrees with you.
He disagrees with everything. It's spring. He wants to go outside and eat some birds.
Right.
you know, the problem is, if you get like 5 flakes, okay, so that's a site. If you get 4 pieces of diagnostic ceramics, you know, pre-contact ceramics, that's not a site then.
Okay.
And how is that not a site? I mean, you have...
Right.
Especially if it's from more than one hole, or, you know, maybe even more than one different type of ceramics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've done is we've started kind of doing a point system where every artifact gets 1 point, and then extra meaningful artifact types are given additional points. So, you know, if you have 3 artifacts and there are 2 tool fragments and a pot sherd, you easily will make the 5-point system, mm-hmm. The 5 points. So say, and I'm doing off the top of my head, I'm not looking at the chart, so bear with me. If you had like a lithic tool, that's 1 point for just being an artifact, and then like another point for being a tool. If it's a diagnostic, you'd get even more points. So basically, and that's for reporting to the state for a Smithsonian trinomial.
Mm-hmm.
Below that, they're assigned a unregistered site number, a U.S. number, and then recorded. And so they're still GPSed and still recorded. So you can do like what Bill was talking about,
right?
Pull them all up on the GIS. But you know, like, not all artifacts mean the same thing. And you know, 5 flakes versus 3 point bases are, you know, you're kind of doing it backwards,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the cutoff is. I'm not a huge fan of sites anyway. I think it's a really weird concept, and it doesn't mean much outside of just a management system.
Right.
So I Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it makes sense to save paperwork and not have to fill out like a full site report. But I do think that stuff needs to be recorded.
Well, I think that is the key point there, what you just said, is to save paperwork. Whatever state you're talking about, whatever their standards are for recording isolates versus sites, was probably almost completely based on a financial and time-saving decision. You know, they said these projects are costing way too much because we're recording 100 sites, you know, per so many acres. Let's just increase how many artifacts makes a site and reduce the amount of paperwork involved. And on one level, like you said, Stephen, on one level, I'm okay with that, because defining a site as far as the, you know, the average, you know, archaeologist goes is kind of completely different than the Native Americans or historic period people that created those sites. You know, we're just trying to come up with this arbitrary definition of site. So like you said, I don't really care what's a site or an isolate, as long as they're properly recorded, and whether that, as long as that means they go on a GIS. If it's an isolate, fine. It doesn't take that long to jot down some details about it and then get it into the statewide or agency wide GIS for that area.
Well, I was going to say one thing I was thinking about as far as digging the shovel probes. I don't know if this is true in Wisconsin, but in Washington, if you found flakes in a shovel probe, then you had to dig 4 more shovel probes in the cardinal directions 5 meters apart from right. that. And that's how you outlined all the sites. So I remember if somebody found flakes in a shovel probe and I could get on the phone, I was calling my boss right away like, hey, everything's probably going to be blown because this person found some flakes in their shovel probe. And that person may spend days just digging, you know, doing Battleship, digging shovel probes every 5 meters. And that could really destroy a budget. So I don't know if that's the way it is in Idaho, but...
We do that here, but that doesn't destroy a budget because, you know, we plan on it. And even the U.S., the sites that fall below the threshold of reporting, we're still bracketing all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You can't, if you get any positives, you can't not bracket it.
Right.
And it doesn't, you know, I think in the Northwest, their shovel tests, or what they call shovel tests, are a little more labor intensive than what we do. You know, like 4 would be, I don't know, 45 minutes of extra work for one person. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to kill you, especially if it's an isolate. And if it's not an isolate, then great, because you're actually finding a site, and that's important. And that's what we're doing. Or we're supposed to be doing.
Right, yeah.
Right. And the problem is, if you get that attitude of, oh no, we just blew the budget because we found stuff, eventually you're going to be trying to not find stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've seen that, and it's a horrible thing to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to say that the only reason I would call back is because there was always like exceptions. So yeah, we always anticipated on finding a site or finding something, you know, if there was going to be something there. But say one person's digging their brackets, and then 45 meters down the road, another person ends up finding another one. You don't know if those are two sites. You don't know if your contract or your scope of work allow how many sites that allows you to record or whatever. And so either they have to send more people out there or they have to ask for a modification. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we were never not trying to find sites, but you need to know whether more people need to come or whether, you know, it's okay to just keep going for a month out there or, you know, what's going on, because some clients are, you know, tightwads. And if they find out that, you know, you found two sites or something like that, they don't want to give you a mod, then you just stop working.
Right.
But I find that really weird that they can dictate how many sites you're going to find before you find anything.
No, yes, you're right. Most companies will take an educated guess, like, okay, there's a village right next door. Yeah, there's a site within this area. Or there's a railroad track right there. Yeah, there's a site within this thing. And so they'll say that, you know.
Well,
but you're right. You're right.
There's nothing in the regs that state, like, you shall only find so many sites. I mean, it's you're supposed to just go out there and look for sites and do your good faith effort.
Well, Stephen, here in Nevada, it comes down to proposal writing. you know, when I, if I'm writing a proposal for a project and it's, I look where the geometry is, I look where the project area is, I'll look on the NevCrist system here, which is online, which is a couple years out of date, but it's pretty close. And I'll look at areas, well, I'll look at that area and see if it's ever been recorded before, for one thing. And if it hasn't, then I'll go to a valley or two next door and say, you know, see one that has been recorded, look at the site density, and then you interpolate based on that and say to the client, well, I think we'll find, you know, we're going to write this budget for 25 sites. We're going to write this budget for 30 sites. But we put in the assumptions that if more sites are found, then we'll have to do a change order. And that's the condition for the change order, is more sites were found than was anticipated, or larger sites than were anticipated were found. Because we'll say, it depends on how you write your proposal. If you write it specific enough and say, you know, we think we'll find this many sites of this particular size based on what's been found elsewhere in the area, and you have to put in your assumptions that, you know, this is based on previous knowledge and it's an educated guess, but things change when you get on the ground and you guys have to be flexible for that. And that's the condition for the change order. So
I think for you guys, cause you're doing survey and evaluation at the same time, kind of, right?
Yes.
Yeah. See, we don't do that. Here we're using the three phase system where, like, we survey and it's like, okay, here's the list of sites. And then it's up to the client, the agency, to decide what they want to do with those sites. Do they want to evaluate them? Are they just going to, you know, some are just automatically considered not eligible because they're below a certain threshold,
right,
or, you know, frankly, they're just going to be ineligible, and, you know, get written off really quickly that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, like, I, you know, maybe other firms or other agencies have had to deal with something like that. But for us, it's always been go out and find the sites and give us a list of the sites that you find. You know, in your guys' situation, I could see, like, you know, gaming the system by drawing extra big boundaries. So, you know, instead of having two separate sites separated by like 30 meters, you're going to have like one site with, you know, huge gaping mass of nothing in between the lines.
Well, and sometimes we'll do that if it makes sense. If it looks like a site is separated by the 30 meters, you know, so we make them two separate sites, but we get back in the office and we start evaluating these two sites. If something makes us draw a bigger circle around that and say, okay, this is one site now, well then, you know, whatever those criteria are, we'll do that and we'll explain it. But just to be clear, so people know, we are doing evaluations, but there's still recommendations. The SHPO still has to sign off on our evaluation. So we do, you know, we evaluate a site as not eligible or eligible or potentially eligible or something like that. And potentially eligible just means it's probably going to have to go to another phase. So they'll have to avoid it anyway or deal with it, you know, go to, you know, testing or excavation. So, but that's what our stuff is. When we turn in our reports or we turn in our sites for site numbers to the SHPO, we're making recommendations, eligibility recommendations. And the SHPO, like 99% of the time, goes along with the recommendations. If I had to guess, it's primarily because they don't have the time to just go through everything. You know, they probably don't read every single word of the site record. Maybe they do. I don't know. But I would be real surprised if that happened, at least in this state. So we make our recommendations. They come back, give us site numbers. We do the report, and we give it to the BLM or whoever the agency is, typically the BLM here, but however that works. And then we proceed on from there with based on our eligibility recommendations. Let's take a short break and play the first installment of our new Profiles in CRM segment. Enjoy.
This is CRM.
Hi, everybody. It's Ashley with the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and I am here with Dan Martin. And Dan, you're going to have to explain to me your current
affiliation,
please.
So my current affiliation is with HRA. That'll be my next job. But in the last month, I've worked for three different companies, which is not uncommon for me right now.
And you were explaining to me there's an actual temp agency
that I work through one of the companies, HK, that I work for CH2M Hill.
Okay, that's something I haven't quite heard about before. Mm-hmm. So, how long have you been working in CRM?
About 30 years.
That is a long time. I actually didn't know that. I've known Dan for only like a year, I think.
Yeah.
But I had no idea you worked for 2 years now. Yeah. And wow, 30 years. Oh my goodness. So, what is the position you usually have in CRM, and what is the highest position you've attained?
I usually work as a crew member on most jobs. I've been a crew leader before. Generally, I don't enjoy that quite as much. It's harder for me to make people do what they're supposed to do than to do what I'm supposed to do.
So the highest position?
Crew leader.
Crew leader,
yeah.
All right. You briefly touched on where you've worked in terms of companies. Regionally, where have you worked?
Almost all in the Northwest, a little bit in Central California, and mostly Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
Okay. What is the best thing that's happened to you that's related to being an archaeologist?
Finding something very cool. I love doing that.
The discovery.
The discovery, but also the research. Sometimes the research is like finding a little thread on a sweater and pulling it and following it. It unravels. It goes in different directions. You never know quite where it's going to go, especially if you take it seriously. I find the research on things, details that I found in the field to be as much fun, if not more sometimes, than working in the field.
I like that. So then, what is the biggest thing you would change that would make being a CRM archaeologist better?
Somehow to make it more regular, to be able to predict
regular work?
When you'll be working and where you'll be working. So often that's not the case. A lot of times it's important to have a plan B lined up. Things that are definite fall through, other things pop up. It's nice. It would be nice to have a more regularized kind of labor, but that's just part of the nature of CRM too. So mm-hmm. That's the way it goes.
Mm-hmm. What is your career goal in CRM?
To find the coolest thing imaginable.
What would that be for you?
I don't know yet. I'm still looking.
You're still looking.
Yeah.
Okay. And lastly, if you could give an undergrad thinking about cultural resource management one piece of advice, what would it be?
It would be totally contradictory. It would be to narrow your focus, and then also not to narrow your focus.
Mm-hmm. I understand how you feel about that, mm-hmm. because at once you need to understand a broad range mm-hmm. of concepts and methods, but then almost in a way to stay around in CRM, you have to specialize.
You have to find a niche, it's true.
Yeah.
But it's also good to see the wider picture, especially if you're in historic archaeology, mm-hmm. having a wider view of world history, art history, but also some of the big currents in biology, mm-hmm. in geology, mm-hmm. having a really wide view of the world and where it's been and where it's going.
Well, great. Thank you very much,
my
Dan.
Pleasure.
And thanks for chatting with me.
Well, that was dramatic, but I liked it. I think that segment's here to stay. Let's kick it back over to Doug, and he can finish talking about New Mexico and Scotland and how they deal with isolates and other things.
Yeah, isolates in New Mexico are kind of very similar to a lot of what you guys have mentioned. There's a certain amount of artifacts. A fun one is you can actually have fewer artifacts to make a site if, for example, the lithics are different types of material. So if you're pulling out, let's say, obsidian and some sort of chert and Rhyolite or something along those lines. And you can probably go down to as low as like three different items and still call that a site, as long as it's different materials. But let's say if they're all rhyolite, that would be an isolate as well. So it's just a slight variation on basically what you guys have all been describing. It's interesting doing archaeology in the UK in that you don't really have isolates, as it were. So it's just how the commercial archaeology is done. A huge percentage of the countryside has basically been plowed over. So it's plow soil.
Right.
And that basically means it's unfortunate because I think they really could do with a lot more isolate and looking at distributions of artifacts that even if you find in the plow zone, basically because there's a plow zone, archaeology is sort of developed over here where you just don't record surface finds too often. Mm-hmm. There's things like portable antiquities scheme where you're supposed to sort of record that and stuff. And it's a weird mix of records. So some people find something in their field and that'll get recorded. It's all a bit hodgepodge. So there's not a defined, oh, we found three artifacts, that's a site. And what tends to happen is a lot of times when you're doing commercial archaeology, you're not doing shovel test pitting and you're not doing any sort of pedestrian survey. You do pretty much about a 5% scrape back where you get a JCB, so a bulldozer in, scrape back little bits at a time and do an evaluation that way. Mm-hmm. And you end up recording anything you find. And there's not really a definition of a site. In your report, you'd say we'd found these sort of things. And then that report goes off to the local archaeologist and they can decide if more needs to happen with that or not. But in terms of a legal sort of kick in of, oh, we found this and that automatically means it's a site and has to go through this process, doesn't necessarily happen. And it's unfortunate, but a lot of stuff doesn't get recorded as well. So sort of along the whole GIS thing, the whole place, most of the UK is filled with field drains. If you're digging in any fields, you're going to find a field drain. And they're almost always completely, archaeologists don't care about them. They don't get recorded. And there's stuff like that. So the more recent stuff, 1800s, 1900s stuff, a lot of times gets under-recorded or just not recorded at all. And just when they're when they're scraping off, they're like, oh, field drain. And that just doesn't get recorded. Even though, potentially a couple hundred years, that would be, something someone might want to know about and where field drains are, but never get recorded.
That's funny, because I was going to ask you what the age threshold for recording is in the UK. I figured it was about 500 years.
No.
It's 100, right?
No, it's... it's complicated.
I keep hearing all this rumbling about changing the NHPA to a 100-year threshold, and Canada's is 100, and they're, rattling the sabers over the fact that like 40% of the whole country in the next 20 years is going to be potentially need to be evaluated or whatever. So,
well, ARPA's 100. I'm looking at I was looking at a project just a little while ago that was under like ARPA rules, and it was anything less than 100 years old wasn't going to be recorded on this project.
Huh.
Yeah, I actually support the idea of the NHPA switching to 100.
I support it, but it's difficult to say that because some things, like we have a lot of really, really cool mining sites where these huge mining complexes from like the teens and the 20s and these different mining booms that happened in Nevada, and those wouldn't be recorded under those rules. And I think that it's important to record some of those because there's, some of these mining sites, mining technology changed so quickly, throughout the decades as it started up out here in the West, say in the 1840s, and then continuously moved on. You could have a mining site from the 1890s or 1900s that's completely different from a mining site in the teens or the 20s. So, having a rule is nice, but then you've got to have some flexibility.
Well, recording and evaluating, though, you're not causing any harm. if you walk up to a subdivision that was built in 1964 and, you know, you've got to evaluate the building that's right there by the fiber optic line. I mean, obviously you're going to be like, I don't know how this is an exemplary, you know, example of really anything since 40% of the whole country is like this. So
right.
I think evaluating that doesn't seem like it really hurts anything, you know?
Right.
It's not like those things are going to get preserved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my thought is it's more about like, you know, like historical importance that 50 years, I don't think that's long enough to actually determine like, you know, like historical importance rather than just, I don't really know how to say it.
It's complicated.
Well, it's complicated. I think that, you know, part of it is that, you know, one, for things that are 50 years old, you have people still alive who are affiliated with that. And I mean, at that point, you're not even getting close to historical, because it's, you know, it's how they feel about stuff they did. Or worse, it's how their kids think about stuff they did. You know, when you're involving like public interaction and stuff like that. At 100, you're starting, it starts trickling down into more of a historical importance, where it's the community at large and not necessarily people who, you know, really were, you know, like knew the event or the people involved with the events. And I like the idea of, you know, because some things like you say are like, nobody's going to say that, you know, like Ground Zero at the World Trade Center isn't going to be historically important. But it's so, you know, and so there are, you can make exceptions within the National Register. But I think what we can't say is how it's going to be conceived of in 100 years. And my thought is, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'm pretty sure that Tom King has said this sort of thing in his books, that, you know, our recognition of historical importance isn't based on what was going on then so much as how we interpret it now. And I think, so, you know, my thought is it might be good to have, for exceptions, like a 50-year provisional status that would have to be revisited at 100 years. Right. And I'm just saying that, you know, because it's job security for us. But, well, you know, but I really do think, and it's kind of a horrible thing to say, because I think involving the community and getting oral histories of the people involved, all that's really important for more recent events, and they're very useful tools in helping to determine, you know, historical importance of places. But I think that, you know, really, for it to be historically important, we need to be somewhat removed. You know, we're viewing it as a community and things that have passed and not things that are immediately remembered. And it's kind of an aside, but there you go.
Yeah, we totally stole this from Doug. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, actually, I was going to bring something else up. And Doug was kind of touching on this with the field drains. You know, what are we going to do? I really suspect that there's going to be a certain crisis, because we do tend to look at past past surveys, and it's like, yeah, it's been surveyed, we're good to go.
No.
The NHPA is, you know, getting on 60 years or 50, 60 years. And,
50 years.
You know, how many of those 1970s, 1980s trash piles have we just kind of made a really vague note and moved on. You know, it's like, oh, plastic bottles, go.
Well, that question I can answer, Stephen, because that depends on the state. I don't know about other states, but here in Nevada, on BLM land, if you're doing a survey and you're going over previously surveyed area or previously recorded sites, if it was recorded or surveyed more than 10 years ago, then you have to re-record it. You can either do an update to the site, or if the character of the site has changed enough to where it's different enough from the original site record, you just do a completely new re-recording of the site. And in most cases, at the very least, you're going to remap the site. So you're going to have to flag the whole thing out and figure it out, because these weren't mapped. If it's older than 10 years old at this point, there's a good chance it wasn't mapped with a submeter GPS. So we remap everything and then re-photograph everything and basically re-record the whole site all over again if it's over 10 years. So I'm not sure if other states do that.
Yeah, in Arizona, what you're talking about, those trash piles, if it's got historical artifacts in it and stuff, we just record it just like we would a normal site. But I mean, you've seen them. Sometimes there's just a whole mountain of garbage, and it's, you know, from the 1940s and 1930s. So, you know, you'll do like some kind of a sample unit to characterize things, you know, four or five different 50 centimeter squares, and just count how many glass fragments or whatever. And then write a list of all the bottle bases that you could see that have a date or whatnot to prove your point. But in general, those things are not considered eligible. Informal dumps are usually not considered eligible. Or roadside garbage that's along a road, that's usually not considered eligible.
Well, you know, I guess my question isn't about stuff from the 30s and 40s. It's stuff that is too young at the time of survey. And so basically just gets ignored, or, you know, a footnote. But isn't recorded as a site, isn't, you know, maybe is just written off as like, modern debris was identified in this location. But there's really nothing beyond that, because everybody looked at it and was like, oh, look, you know, plastic soda bottles or, you know, stuff like that, you know, things from the 70s, things from the 80s. So they don't, I mean, they still don't qualify as sites, but at some point, they're going to.
Well, where it starts to get crazy too, because I've been on bigger surveys before, like, and I'm sure this has happened to somebody. You start a survey in the fall, you break for the winter, pick back up in the spring, and maybe you had some glass shards, some bases that dated to 1964 last year in the fall. You come back in the spring, you come back over that area. Well, those are historic now because it's 2014 and now they're 50 years old.
Yeah, but they're,
you know, where does the lunacy
generally
stop?
Not eligible. And not only that, but if you have somebody like me who's actually thinking about creating some kind of a dating thing for plastics specifically from the 60s, 70s and 80s. Yeah. You'll still plug them with the GPS as like just a general point. I mean, you could take points. I mean, you could take control points. You could take intersections, power poles, other things that aren't part of the whole survey. And then in the description, you'll write down like, you know, glass Welch's juice base from 1978 or something like that.
Right.
Just to, you know, do it. But, and then you'll also describe that there's tons and tons of litter. But generally, at least in Arizona, and I think most of the country, like the end of the 60s is usually the end of litter, because most people were forced to have trash. So they were forced to have garbage service at their house. And there was also those huge like 70s don't litter campaigns, and, you know, the sad Native American crying from the river that was all polluted and stuff. Those commercials, those all went live in the 70s, and the littering went way down.
There's still a lot of dumping out in rural Wisconsin.
Well, you guys need to rerun that.
They're illegal. But, you know, I mean, and that's just it, is that, you know, you're seeing it starts to fall under, you know, illicit behavior and stuff like that. But, you know, but on the archaeology side of it, you know, people still do litter. People still do, you know, dump. And we, you know, having looked back through, you know, other people's reports, even for the past, you know, 20 years, you know, these things aren't being recorded. And at which point, if we don't even know if there's stuff from the 70s or the 80s, say, you know, at some point these things are going to become sites, and then, you know, all the agencies that have done all this work to get everything surveyed is going to have to go back through and do it all over again, because they don't have a good grasp on, you know, stuff from the 70s and 80s. So if, you know, to kind of call back to early part of the discussion, if we move the National Register to, or the NHPA to 100 years, that gives us an extra 70 years not to worry about it. thank you.
Nice.
It's saving the past for the future, man.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's how we're in the situation we're in right now.
right. Doug, you had to say something earlier. You have we gone beyond that point, or is it still valid?
I mean, I guess it's still valid. But yeah, we've kind of really gone beyond it. I was just going to comment and say that I think, you know, historical preservation has gotten infinitely more complex in the most recent couple of years, now that we're now considering, you know, 1950s, you know, ranch houses and 1960s subdevelopments as potentially being archaeology, or I guess for a better word, historically or a cultural heritage resource. Especially now that with construction, where we just completely obliterate everything. It's amazing. So I used to live on the High Street in Edinburgh, and you could basically walk through all the buildings, and it was amazing because it's about 500-600 years of history, and you can basically see in the buildings where they've knocked out a doorway and then covered it back up, and there used to be a window there, but they've bricked it back up, and we've basically kept all the buildings. And nowadays, everything just gets completely knocked down. You rarely, unless it's, you know, protected, rarely do you actually keep the buildings and try to reuse them as much. And I've noticed that a lot with construction, somewhat in the UK, is more recent buildings are getting knocked down. One, because everything old is, you know, registered and much harder to demolish. But they're really starting to go after like the 1960s and 70s, which, to be honest, I don't think it's exactly a bad thing, in the sense that I really hate how those buildings look. But I, as you know, I realize it's not my personal taste. Someone else might, you know, need it and stuff. But basically, they're starting to knock down the more recent buildings, and so a lot of construction is happening around that. And basically, at a certain point, I don't know, a couple hundred years, you'll have everything that's really old, and then everything that's really new, and between 1950 and, I don't know, 2020, or, you know, 2020, whatever, 2200, I don't know, you know, a couple hundred years from now, there's gonna be no archaeology, because we basically would have said, oh, you know what, it's modern, you can knock it down, and we're basically gonna wipe out potentially next 100 years or so. You know, it's really hard to predict the future, but if we keep knocking down these more recent buildings without recording them or anything like that, we're kind of destroying our future archaeology.
You know, I go kind of back and forth on this, as far as my opinions on that, like, you know, knocking down 1960s and 70s subdivisions and more recent as well. Because on the one hand, you know, I've been to Europe, I've been to the UK, and it is really cool walking through, like you said, Doug. I've been to like Jersey in the Channel Islands, and there were some really cool old places there. In fact, they were having their 800-year anniversary of being a European settlement, because there's been people living there past, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 years. But it was 800 years ago in 2004, I think, that I was there, that they kind of came under the protection of the UK and, or I guess England at the time. And so they have some really old buildings and really old streets there. And it's just a really cool thing. You know, that being said, I'm also kind of on the cusp of the digital generation, where I'm kind of fine with the way that we have history recorded going back to like the 60s and 70s, whether it's movies, newspapers, you know, books, descriptions, all this stuff. I don't think I need to physically see it. I don't think I need to see a preserved suburban neighborhood from the 50s to really appreciate it. I can see a virtual version of that, you know, whether it's in, you know, Google SketchUp or Second Life or some other, you know, Oculus could come up, you know, now that Facebook owns Oculus, they could create some sort of virtual thing and you could walk through this 1960s neighborhood sitting in your living room. I'm fine with that, quite honestly. But then on the other hand, for our descendants 300 years from now, would it be cool for them to walk through a 1970s neighborhood, or would they be fine doing it virtually?
Well, not even.
And that's my idea about 100 years, though, is that, you know, we're fine with, you know, tearing down the 60s and 70s right now because it's too familiar. You know, and as time goes on and those neighborhoods become more and more rare, that's when, you know, historical importance of, you know, from a design perspective would become a lot more poignant.
But the point is, we have the information in multiple formats. Do we need the actual
thing? Except we don't have it in multiple formats.
Yeah,
that's the thing
that,
is.
But you don't get the experience. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was just saying is, I'm not opposed to, even when we do commercial archaeology, most of our excavations means almost completely that the site's going to be destroyed. So that's, you know, Native American 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 years ago. Or, you know, if you're here, Celtic, Iron Age, all that stuff getting knocked down and excavating. And that's, you know, that's how we learn a bit is archaeology destroys it. It's just that when it comes to, you know, 1960s, 1970s, we do absolutely nothing. There is no 3D models. There's no going through with photogrammetry and recording things. There, I mean, it just doesn't happen. When you, I mean, if you look at it, the 50 year mark in the U.S., nothing happens. And as long as it's under 50 years, you basically are able to just bulldoze it through and nothing gets recorded. And so I'm not saying that the whole world should be becoming a living museum and then once something's built, it shouldn't change. I'm just a little concerned that we do tend to now knock down only the newer, well, relatively newer buildings because you don't have to go through the pain of all the historic recording and stuff, and we just don't record them. And so I think that would be the issue, is not so much that they get knocked down, because I fully believe that, you know, stuff has to change and you do have to move forward, and not every building can be there, and, you know, stuff has to move forward. But I'm a little concerned that we basically are knocking down, not recording the last couple of decades of buildings, and sort of assuming that, oh, you know, we'll have pictures and videos and stuff of it. And when you go to the archives and stuff, yeah, you have more pictures and photos than at any point in history. I mean, 1800s, you had to kind of rely on someone painting something. But even that is not enough to really recreate or create 3D models or even kind of give you a feel of what build it. You usually get the outside of buildings. You have no idea what they look like on the inside. Sorry, I'm ranting. I'll stop.
That's all right. I wanted to remind everyone the reason we have these laws, in the United States at least, is because almost 50 years ago, cities decided that they could go through and tear down all those 1890s and 1900s slums and wastelands, and that all these run-down, crappy old craftsmen and – well, maybe not craftsmen because they were still living in those, but – maybe all these old Victorian and, you know, things that we would say are like 120 years old, these old industrial centers and neighborhoods that were full of all the undesirables, the others, those were not fit for keeping. So cities just took bulldozers and the government encouraged them to just rip down these inner cities and rip down these neighborhoods that were, you know, now we would be, you know, absolutely shocked since we have so few of those neighborhoods left. And just bore out their downtowns and pray for development. And people freaked out. You know, they saw these neighborhoods that were, you know, right after cities got started or in the West, you know, some of the earliest neighborhoods in the whole town just getting bulldozed down like they were nothing. And so they created these preservation laws. So right now what Doug's describing, the same thing's going on in the UK, a whole time periods being designated as garbage, and they're going to just go through and rip them all down until architects and architectural historians and maybe archaeologists decide, hey, wait a minute, we've destroyed a huge portion of this whole time period. We have to take action. We have to save these things. I mean, that's why the 50-year rule, developed slowly over time through several different laws, and you know, it was written in into the NHPA, where it already kind of informally existed with the Park Service before that, because the rule before that was, you know, 18, I think it was like 1890 or something like that was just the date. So in the 1930s, they decided, well, 1890 or 1880, that's the time period. Before that, you know, that all is historical, and after that, it's not. Well, by the 60s, you know, that was, you know, pretty far back there, and urban renewal was going on, and they already had this unspoken policy where generally 50 years, you know, we're just going to try to preserve that, even though there's exceptions. There was presidents' homes in the 60s and 70s that got preserved that weren't quite 50 years old. And there's a lot of talk about preserving Ground Zero or turning that into a historical site, even though it's not even 20 years old. So, you know, that was the destruction that Doug's talking about was the motivation for us to have historical laws or historic preservation laws.
Okay, well, with that, our discussion of isolates is probably going to have to come to a stop.
I just chopped that piece out and put it somewhere else.
Oh, my God. So I think Alex goes on in his email to ask about planning for retirement and things like that. I think we'll save that for the next show. Okay, I'm going to play now Ashley's interview with Kelly Bush. She owns a CRM consulting firm in Washington State, but I'll let them talk about that. I just wanted to say real quick that Ashley and Kelly had to move all around the conference center probably 3 or 4 times because they kept having audio challenges, so take that into account. There will be a few door slams. You'll hear a vacuum cleaner at one point, and I think they end up in a stairwell for the end of the interview. So, got to give it to Ashley for perseverance, and thank you to Kelly for dealing with all those audio challenges. I think the interview went well. Here it is.
Hi, everybody. It's Ashley Morton with the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and joining me is Kelly Bush of Equinox Research and Consulting International, Incorporated, and we've just been chatting a little bit about gender in CRM. And most recently, we're just talking about Kelly having a woman-owned business. And how do you feel about the limitations and advantages of being a woman-owned business and getting more clients, per se, because of that, but then also the drawbacks that come with it as well and what have you. So, Kelly.
Thanks, Ashley. Thanks for having me here. So, I think that I consider myself more a small business first than a woman-owned business. And although I own the business and run it myself, I'm not registered with the state or feds as a woman-owned business. But if I was, it would provide me with contracting advantages in a number of federal pools for contracts where the agencies are requiring minimum levels of woman-owned business involvement. So currently, there is an advantage to being registered as a woman-owned business. I've just stayed so busy that I haven't had time, really, to do that paperwork. As far as the disadvantages to it, in my experience running my business here in Washington for 13 years, there hasn't been a disadvantage for being a woman-owned business that I've been able to perceive. We are a hard-working group of highly trained professionals, and my guys, and I use that term gender-free, primarily have women that work for me, work super hard, and because of that, we're able to keep a strong thread of science and ethics through our projects, which I actually believe you can have a business plan in CRM that's driven by science and ethics, but it requires a team of people who are willing to work a little harder and a little longer and really put in what you need to in order to gather the kind of data that you need to stay on that edge. CRM, by definition, is an industry, and we use archaeology and the science of archaeology to help pursue our industry goals of managing and protecting archaeological sites in a world that is constantly threatening them. Mm-hmm. So gender's a real thing, but I have spent my whole life focusing on producing high-quality work, working hard, mm-hmm. and surrounding myself with people who have similar goals and similar work ethic. And that's been the drive of our success, is having a good time doing what we do, being excited about the work that we do, and working as hard as we can mm-hmm. to manage and protect sites. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's been the bigger piece of the story, is finding a good team who likes to do things the same way that you do, and making that team stronger, and finding clients who align with your ideas. We spend a great deal of our time managing risk. Mm-hmm. So if we have a client who's not interested in managing risk, then it's probably not a good fit.
So have you ever gone through the steps of agreeing to work with a client, sign contracts, and then decided through the process that it wasn't a good fit and cut those? Have you decided to cut those, or do you just try to work through the relationship to see the project through? Obviously, that's challenging, identifying when, you know, to kind of
cut and run.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've done both. So generally, if I've signed a contract or made a verbal agreement with somebody, I'll finish it. Mm-hmm. If it becomes apparent that it's not a good fit, then I'll find a way either to finish the project to a certain point, or to find a way that we can part feeling like we both got to the place that we needed to get to. There have certainly been times where we've had to leave contracts or projects because it became impossible to continue working. I think that there is a huge value in pushing through, even with people who seem unable to follow the same path that you're on. Now that I'm old, I'm much better at identifying whether or not somebody's going to be a good fit for our business.
Up front. What do you look for?
People who are smart, willing to be creative, who understand that every project has a lot of resources, and they are competing, and their issues and interests are sometimes competing. But that doesn't mean you can't work through things. Mm-hmm. So it's really just about people who are willing to be creative and consider alternatives.
Okay. Now, that actually reminds me of the talk you gave yesterday on working with your client and going beyond that phrase that you should do whatever it is that they need to do involving cultural resources because it's the law.
Right.
And I really enjoyed hearing that discussion, because many of us, you know, it's like, well, that's what it is, but trying to be creative and think of how to actually interact and do those kinds of things that get the client excited. And one of them I thought was really interesting, one tactic I thought was very interesting, was sharing stories about the project area in which they're trying to do whatever it is, habitat restoration or what have you. And so if you wouldn't mind just briefly talking a little bit about that session, or the talk that you gave.
Sure.
And some of the things I know you got towards the end, you're trying to wrap up.
Right.
We missed some of that stuff, and I certainly would love to hear a little bit more on your thoughts.
Sure. Yeah, I think that getting clients to really consider what it is they're doing, and to get them on the bus with you with whatever plan you're proposing, you have to do a couple different things. You have to give them buy-in, and find a way for them to get excited about their project and your part in it. Mm-hmm. And two ways you can do that are, as you said, telling the story. People often don't know the depth of fascinating pieces about their project area, whether it's a home that they want to build or a habitat restoration project. All of these places have many stories tied to them, stories about culture, stories about history, prehistory. There's stories about plants, animals, and all of the other interactions with the landscape. That's one of the cool things about archaeology, is that we explore humans' interactions with the landscape, and every place on the planet has stories associated with that. I try to find those stories and give them to people so that they get excited about the place that they're trying to develop or change. The other piece that I always sell, and it works, is that if they're creative about their plan, it will be cheaper for them. I can show them over and over and over again that by being creative in their design plans and how they propose to build either their dream house or their Walmart, they will be able to save money and time, and both of those things are important to most people. So we try to do some historic research, ethnographic research. We try to find out what's happened in the place that's being developed, both the exact location and then its setting within the town or the bay or along the river, and tie that piece of property into a bigger story. I actually believe that the stories are the things that motivate people.
So when you are contracted to do that, whether it's building the Walmart or the dream home, or it's, and most recently I've seen in this conference, damage control for construction projects, ripping up sites, that particularly is a already tension-filled situation. When you are contracted and people are looking for you to help with that, do you prepare for meetings that you have? Okay, this is the history. At what stage do you really, you know, try to get them excited about, okay, yes, you've done this thing, or you're interested in building this at what stage do you really try to get in and get them excited?
Second sentence in the conversation.
Okay.
So you have to convince them from the moment they start talking to you that you have a story to tell them about their project or their project area. So the two tools that I use the most are listening and compiling the story. And those are the things that will help you understand what it is that they're trying to do and what their underlying issues are. Mm-hmm. And if you listen carefully and watch them carefully, mm-hmm. you'll be able to figure out what are the real sort of profound issues with all of the parties. So if you have a group of people or a group of stakeholders who may all have different issues and interests, you're tracking a lot of people's needs or fears. But it's really the only way that you can figure out how to help them find common ground. It's like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. You dump the puzzle out on the table, everybody gets a grab at it. Mm-hmm. So everybody's got different pieces. You've got to convince them to put the pieces together and make that picture. Mm-hmm. And the story really helps doing that.
And then also be willing, you had mentioned in your talk, also be willing to give a little, mm-hmm. right? And
everybody's got to give a little.
Yeah, yeah.
It sucks.
What won't you, is there something you could suggest that you won't give on? And what maybe, it's very difficult for us in the CRM profession, and it's certainly a case-by-case situation in which you're gauging, you know what, this is just not what I'm gonna give on, because it's, you know, doing right by the resource. And obviously our ultimate goal is always to do right by the resource. But have you sort of learned in your experience You know, I initially thought that this was something I just couldn't ever put my, let my foot off of, and have learned to work around, or...
Yeah, I guess it would be how you would define that, but I don't know that there's anything that I don't consider. Most of the work that I do isn't about my idea. I'm just one person, and I frankly don't have all the answers. I think mostly I try to provide a forum for people to, on one hand, describe their project and the things that they have to answer to, and then, on the other hand, allow a forum for somebody to describe their feelings or attachments to the resources that we're trying to protect or manage. So,
so really just staying open?
I would say, yeah, staying neutral, collecting a lot of information, and then trying to find some proposals that everyone will be able to live with. When we talk, you know, if you're talking about a basic ethic on the idea of selling out, I'm not sure that I don't think you ever have to sell out. I don't think that's really part of it. You can just always stay on the front edge of protecting as much as you can possibly protect, given the laws that we have, given the settings that we have, and the players. People may give up things that you have no true knowledge of why they're willing to give that up, and nor do you need to. I don't have that kind of skill or knowledge base to know every reason or the meaning behind every person's decision. It's easy for me to say no because I'm old now. So if I think that something's wrong, it's easy to say no. That's a bad idea. Here's all the reasons why that's a bad idea. You know, it's going to cost more. It's going to get you sued. There's all sorts of things. And so it's not my responsibility to compromise the resource. It's my responsibility to do everything that I can to protect and manage it. But there's a whole pool and string of people who will be involved in making big decisions about every resource on every project we work on. I think the biggest thing is to trust the people that you're working with. Don't be afraid to ask for more information. Get help from people who have craft specialties that know more than you do. If you need a project to go over, around, under, you know, a resource, then you ask an engineer. You tell them what your problem is, and you say, look, in order for me to get your project to go through, I need you to design this. They'll do it. So I think, yeah, the trick is to not get on a position about anything. Stay on the edge of problem solving. Listen clearly so you can identify the problem well. Get help when you need it. Yeah. So there's certainly been times where I'm thinking of a specific project where I had two tribes and a project proponent and an agency, and we're all meeting on site and we're all trying to come up with the best solutions. And I didn't believe that the solution that they were all agreeing to was the best one, but they were all agreeing to it, and it was, you know, certainly one I could live with, and I was super excited that they were all agreeing to it. So, and I think that in the long run, it played out okay. And, you know, my idea didn't need to be the one way we went. This one worked. This one worked for people. The resources were protected. I was okay with it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a couple of questions, just kind of basic stuff, but one, just a sort of introduction, a little background of yourself and where you went to, where, education, where you've been working regionally, specialty, that kind of a thing, and then kind of work our way into a couple other specifics.
So I started doing archaeology up in British Columbia back in the 80s. I went to SFU and got a bachelor's degree there. Actually, I started at a community college and was inspired by a professor there and decided to go on to SFU. Super glad I made that decision. When I left high school, I was never going to go to college. I worked fishing, I did construction, I did a wide range of other things. And after one particularly long winter where the cod fishing, where the market had fallen out and I'd been eating codfish for months, I went back to school. And super glad I did. And in the archaeology program at SFU, I met people who I liked and who seemed like they were all doing interesting and cool things. And I had a particular interest in working outside and a lot of skills around working outside. So it was an easy leap for me. And after doing archaeology up in BC for 4 years, I thought, well, I probably ought to go to grad school. So I wanted to go to grad school where I had a woman professor, so that narrowed it down. And
well, what was it that you were looking for, a woman professor in particular?
So in the 90s, gender issues were at the forefront of archaeology, and I felt like it would be. There was lots of new archaeology going on, new at the time. Feminist archaeology that was
Joan Jarrow, Meg Conkey, exactly. All those awesome ladies.
Yes, Alison Wiley in Canada.
Oh,
yeah,
I have a crush on her.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people do. Yeah, no. So that was the time, and wet site work and women's tools and brothels.
Janet Spector. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I thought, I want to work with a woman, and I would prefer to work with a woman who had some background in CRM. Okay, that limited it down.
Oh, yeah.
So I was super excited that I got into the program at Western with Sarah Campbell, who had both of those things. And so when I finished my master's, I was still working primarily on the plateau in British Columbia. Lithics were what I liked to do, and field work was my specialty, so that was what I was good at, was being in the field. But at the time, I got married in that same period and had my son in 98, and I still worked up in BC, but after a couple years, I realized that it would be better for me to be working a little closer to home. He was getting too big to pack through the woods. So I opened up Equinox down here with a partner from BC. I bought him out a couple years later, but we've had the office here for 13 years. And I've learned a lot about a lot of different things, primarily about doing archaeology in the United States, which has a different set of laws. Canada doesn't have a functional set of federal laws to help manage or protect archaeological resources. So I learned about state law here in Washington, which is different than the Heritage Conservation Act in BC, and how to work with the federal law and federal agencies. So, I guess the difference is I've learned about a lot of other types of archaeological site types. I do a lot of coastal work now, a lot of urban archaeology, a lot of historic archaeology, and the trick for me was to start working with people who were specialists in what they did, and now our team is super well-rounded. We have a great bioanthropologist, we have a great faunal specialist, historic person, and so our staff meetings are awesome. People are,
awesome.
Yeah, their interests are so great and varied. And
that's building that team, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To the expertise and mm-hmm. tasks that they can do and knock it out the park and
right.
do what you gotta, to get done and be
awesome.
Awesome, exactly.
And when you're awesome, then you get to wake up every morning and be excited about it.
Yeah.
And that's what I tell people, is like, if you can stay excited about your job, you're going to be great in your job. and it's actually your job to stay excited about it. So find out the things that you're good at. Focus on the way you can think about, you know, if you dig, you know, 4,000 shovel tests in a summer and they're all negative, you have got to find ways to stay excited about that work.
Yes.
You got to start telling a story about every shovel test in your mind. You've got to start examining those sediments closely. You got to be thinking about settlement patterns and land use strategies. You've got to be thinking
about... Keep your mind engaged.
Engaged. Yeah. Keep it engaged. Think about how the work that you're doing is going to be meaningful.
I love that. I really, it is encouraging to hear that, especially from professionals who've been in the game and in CRM in particular for
decades
now. Exactly. Because, you know, this podcast is one example in which we're trying to show that CRM is as exciting as academic archaeology, if not more, because the challenge is, we don't choose our research sometimes, and what you might uncover that you wouldn't otherwise be interested in, etc. So I'm just gonna go on for a couple of questions here. So you're saying you've been in it for decades. How long have you been doing CRM then?
I volunteered on my first project in 1986, Keatley Creek, with Brian Hayden, and have been doing archaeology pretty steadily since then.
Excellent. So your position that you currently have is principal for your company. I would say that's the highest position that you've attained. Is there a position higher that you foresee? Would it be something like towing between academia and CRM? I know you've taught some classes, right, with Western Washington.
Mm-hmm. I like what I do, and I like the way I get to do what I do. So I run my own companies, I get to take the projects that I want, and I get to challenge myself and my team in ways that are interesting and fun for me. So I have a great deal of control over how we do what we do, and that's served me really well. It's been a great place for me to raise my son. It's been a great place for me to learn how to be an awesome archaeologist. So that part I feel pretty excited about. As far as other career moves, there's lots of things that interest me. I like what I'm doing right now, so I'm focusing on that. I don't foresee teaching in an academic setting, but getting a PhD would be a lot of fun. I got to get my kid through college first. I love going to school, so that's like be just like a great gift to myself to go back to school, set aside some time to do more of that. But no, I like what I'm doing. I like getting to work on projects that I have some control over. So
great. So then, what is the best thing that's happened to you that's related to being an archaeologist?
Wow, the list of that is really, 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 really long. I have a lot of best things. I guess I've had some pretty exciting moments in the field, finding things, so that's been pretty cool. I've had some great moments where I watch people who I've worked with for years do something great. That's super exciting. I have people who come back after 10 years saying, wow, you inspired me to become an archaeologist. Those moments are always great too. I think I feel pretty lucky to have a career that's, I don't know, full of interesting and exciting things. When I was young, I'm going to say it was my second year of doing field work, I was mapping an old wagon trail, and I tripped on something on the ground that ended up being the edge of a house pit, that ended up being the edge of house pit village that hadn't been recorded, and that was a really exciting day. And that probably got me hooked.
Okay, Kelly, what is your career goal in CRM?
Well, I think I already got there. I like doing what I'm doing. So,
all right.
I like working in a small firm because we get to be really light on our feet and we get to pick and choose what we do. I like building teams, and so we're building an awesome team where we are. And I have, there's enough flexibility in the job that I have right now that I keep getting to learn new things. So I get to take trainings, I get to work with people who are specialists in their field and learn about their fields. And we're making a difference on the ground, and our work is really applicable. I got a call this morning from WashDOT wondering about the techniques we used in Oak Harbor because they need to figure out what to do about the OSO slide. And so they're going to use some of the data from the work that my crew did to figure out how to help people find their loved ones today.
That is so exciting. And I mean, for one, to be recognized in your own methodology of dealing with damage assessment, but that's a wider discussion that archaeology does help people, and we've got to do more about that. All right, last question, Kelly. It is, if you could give an undergrad thinking about CRM one piece of advice, what would it be?
Wow, one piece of advice, Ashley. Okay, learn how to like hard work. If you can work really hard, especially through things that you don't like to do, you'll be able to carve yourself out time to do the things that you do like to do. And that's been, that has served us really well at Equinox, where if we get our shovel test done really quickly, then we can spend some time in the analysis. And I feel like archaeology is a field science, and CRM is all about using archaeology and the field techniques. And if you can learn how to get those field skills and the logistics down, and you can learn how to push through and enjoy hard work, then you're going to be able to go different places and do different things and spend more time thinking about what it is that we do and how the data that you're gathering can create those stories that engage people and make a difference. And we can't be everywhere all at once protecting archaeological sites. The only way to do that is to engage the public and have them protect those sites for you. If you work hard and you learn how to enjoy that, people will see that you're a hard worker and they'll respect you for that. And they'll listen to your story.
That is well said, I would say. Well, thank you very much for taking some time out of your hectic conference schedule. And I will certainly be looking forward to, hopefully in the very near future, having a full episode with the rest of the panelists, because I think we all would enjoy further picking your brains. And perhaps even particularly another ladies episode of the CRM podcast addressing additional gender issues and getting into a personal interest of mine is how far women have gone since the 90s and what you're talking about when gender scholarship was taking off and that sort of thing. So again, thank you, Kelly.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for the podcast, which can be found at www.digtech-llc.com/podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for this episode. You can also email me at archeowebby@gmail.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email me at archeowebby@gmail.com. Again, use the contact form on the podcast page of the website, or tweet your questions using the hashtag CRMArchPodcast. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook, be sure to use the hashtag CRMArch so the community can see it and comment on it. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Adios.